This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Hot Topics episode number 14 was recorded on Sunday evening, April 26th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. I'll tell you how to claim a free copy of their new guide to the best investing books ever written at the end of this episode. Joining me today is Jim Bianco, founder of Bianco Research. Now, for any listeners, if that name doesn't immediately ring a bell, Jim, first of all, is a very accomplished macro and fixed income guy. That's not the part I want you to key in on, though. Jim is the guy who, from day one of the coronavirus crisis, has been two steps ahead of me. He's probably the only guy in finance who, I'll be the first to acknowledge, had it figured out well before I did. The reason that we're doing this special episode today is Jim gave me a call this afternoon to run some thoughts by me, and by the time we were done, we said, boy, this could be big. If we're right about this, it really could be a major black swan event in markets, bigger than what we've seen so far in the oil market with respect to the impact of the supply and demand imbalances and so forth. Jim prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany this podcast. It contains graphs and charts that we're going to be referring to, so I strongly encourage you to download it and watch along as you listen. You can find the download link in the description of today's podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com, right next to Jim's picture. Now, folks, we're not necessarily predicting a crisis or a black swan, but we're going to let you judge from the considerations that we're thinking about. We see that there's pretty significant risk. Jim, thanks so much for joining me on short notice and putting a podcast together on this subject. When we first started our conversation earlier today, you started with a few anecdotes about the way most crises tend to start and what they have in common. Please share that with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Eric. All financial crises are usually started because what you thought was not possible becomes possible. You're only as good as your weakest assumption. So in 2008, what was not possible was a decline in national housing prices. Yes, individual markets could go down, but others are supposed to go up, but they're not all supposed to go down at the same time. And that's what happened in 2008. You saw the same thing happen in 1987. When the stock market crashed then as well too, that portfolio insurance was not supposed to breed more selling, and then it got out of control as well. So what I think we want to discuss here today is the assumption that no one thought was possible that became possible, and that's negative prices in an important commodity like crude oil, and it has big ramifications just beyond what producers and consumers of crude oil have. It has big ramifications for the financial system as well, too.
I think there's actually several assumptions here that we're questioning. You just hit maybe the consequence of it, but there's also another one, which is, you know, everybody always takes it for granted, Jim. Well, you know, in the crude oil market, it's just the way it works. 90% of those contracts that are being traded are going for paper settlement. The people that are trading, for the most part, don't have any intention of either making or taking physical delivery. And of course, there are a handful that do, but those balance out in the end. There's about the same number of those on either side of the trade. And if there's a little bit of imbalance, hey, the price discovery mechanism takes care of it. No big deal. I think the key contention that we're really focusing on is maybe under these circumstances, there's a big imbalance there between how many of the longs have the ability and intention to accept physical delivery and how many of the shorts have the intention of delivering as opposed to closing their contracts for cash settlement as we approach expiration day. So we're going to come back to the reasons Jim and I are questioning those key assumptions and what it could mean in terms of an epic dislocation in the crude oil market, much bigger than what we've seen so far. But before we get to that, there's a really important kind of perfect storm event, which is going to start, we think, on Tuesday of this week. It's going to be kind of the setup that brings more money into this market. Jim, explain what's so special about Tuesday, the 28th of April.
The largest crude oil ETP, which is an exchange-traded product, it is technically an ETP, not an ETF, is USO, the United States Oil Fund. It is going to do a 1-for-8 split of its stock. It currently trades around $2.50 a share. By doing a 1-for-8 split, economically nothing changes, except for every 8 shares you get one new share, and the new price should be around $20. And I think that that's going to do two things. One, it's going to give the perception that there was a big jump in crude oil prices. But two, it's going to be more relatable for the average retail investor. See, and they want to buy crude oil, they go to USO, and they see a price of $2.50, and they go, wait a minute, the price of crude oil is $20, and this is $2.50. I might add, years of paying contango is eaten away at its value, which is why it's fallen that much. But now that they've readjusted the price to something close to the price of crude oil, it'll make it, in a retail investor's mind, more relatable to the price of crude oil, encouraging them to want to jump into this contract even harder with both feet. And to that end, let me show you on page 7 of my slide deck is the United States Oil Fund, USO. And that is, its price is in red, and in green is the number of accounts at the trading app Robinhood that own that. Now, quick word about Robinhood. It is one of the fintech startups that was started in 2015. They were the leaders in charging no commissions in trading. They have gone in 5 years from a startup to 10 million accounts, which makes them about the size of Charles Schwab. And so they're a good retail sentiment reading. The beginning of last week, 7 days ago, 62,000 accounts held USO in their account. By Tuesday, it was up to 100,000 accounts. By Friday, it was up to 196,000 accounts. That's the green line. That means we doubled twice last week. This is growing faster than the coronavirus right now. And this is an indication of how retail is piling into these long-only ETPs to try and play for a bounce of crude oil. The slide on the next page is the second largest ETP, which is the ProShares Ultra Crude Oil ETF. That has about $700 million in it, where USO has about $3.3 billion in it. And it has seen its account numbers go from about 10,000 holders back in late March, a month ago, to 50,000 right now. By the way, this one is levered. It's 2 times the price of crude oil as well, too. So the public is killing themselves to get into this. On the Robinhood platform, USO was the number one traded instrument all of last week. More than Apple, more than Google, Microsoft, take your pick, more than spiders, QQQs. It was USO. And why is everybody getting in on it? Because they think the price of crude oil has bottomed. And they hear the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin say, we're going to bail out the energy industry. That, in their mind, means the price is going to go up. They got to get in. And then Tuesday, with the reverse split, it's going to make more sense to them because the price of crude oil is $20. The USO will be $20 or thereabouts. And I think that they will continue to flood into this instrument.
Well, Jim, I am just bracing myself for the onslaught of tweets and emails from listeners who say, look, it just went up. It was $2.50 and you said it wasn't a good investment and it went up to $18. You're such an idiot. It was so wrong. I can't believe I didn't buy it. And of course, they won't understand. The price didn't go up. The price changed. Nobody made money on that. The people that bought it at $2.50 didn't make a profit because the price has gone up to $18. They might have actually lost a little bit of profit because they have 1/8 as many shares now. But I think it's not going to register. Let's suppose that you're right, Jim, and I think that you are. that when the price is suddenly $20 and everybody remembers it was $2 last week, and these are our novice investors who don't really know what they're doing, it sounds like it's taken off. It sounds like the people who were bought it at $2 were the geniuses. It's 20. I better pile in before I miss my chance. This is it, baby. Let's put my life savings into this one. If that happens, Jim, every futures contract, of course, the USO fund is nothing but a product that owns futures contracts on the futures exchange. Every futures contract has a buyer and a seller. There has to be a short for every long. So we've got a whole bunch of new long money that we expect to come into the market this week as a result of the reverse split on USO. Now, normally, there's lots of people that might be the sellers of those contracts. Could be hedge funds, could be lots of different people. We think it might be a little different this time. Tell us what's on your mind, Jim.
Yes, Eric, if you go to slide number 2 on my handout, I want to just quickly explain to people what's been happening fundamentally in the market. It shows U.S. gasoline demand right now. And U.S. gasoline demand has fallen off a cliff from 10 million barrels a day. So 10 million barrels of crude oil a day in the United States was used to make gasoline. We're now down to 6 million barrels a day to use gasoline. The chart I show goes back 21 years, but you can actually go back to the 1960s to find the last time that gasoline demand was this low. So we're not driving and we're not consuming gasoline. So if you go to slide 3, the inventories have been soaring. So you could see the week of April 10th, inventory builds of U.S. crude oil was 20 million barrels in 1 week, the largest ever recorded. The following week, the week of the 17th, the latest data, was 15 million barrels, the second largest weekly number ever. We're going to get the numbers this week for the week ending on the 24th. You're probably going to continue to see more of that as well, too. So if you go to the slide number 4, what's been happening is crude oil inventories have been bloating. Floating storage, that is all the oil tankers on the seas right now, is now floating around with 120 million barrels of oil in storage. Double, more than double what is normally the line. The red line is 2020 floating storage. The blue line is the average of 2016 to 2019. And if you go to slide 5, it shows you the inventories and the capacity of crude oil storage in the United States. This is everything. The orange line shows you that there's 518 million barrels in storage. We have 599 million barrels of available capacity. So the bottom chart shows you that we're running at 86% of capacity, which took out the 2017 high. And I'll remind you that in 2017, you still had plenty of floating storage available, which you don't have now. And if you go to slide 6, this just zeroes in on Cushing, Oklahoma, the delivery point for the West Texas Intermediate contract and the pipeline crossroads of America. They have 76 million barrels of storage in Cushing. They're up to 60 million right now. Even though the chart below shows that that's only 78%, at the amount of builds that we have and the number of people that have already pre-booked storage for the next couple of weeks, we should be out of storage for crude oil in the next couple of weeks. Somewhere by the middle of May is what the estimates are that we're going to run out of crude oil. That is an important thing to understand, which is why the contract is in super contango, because it is anticipating that storage is going to get very tight and it's going to be very difficult to find storage. So you're going to have to pay a lot for it. So that's the fundamental backdrop that we're seeing that's causing the structure of these prices to go in this way. Now, the problem with this is that if you are a producer of crude oil and you drill it and you want to sell it, everybody's telling you, I got no storage. Well, there is a way out. And the way out is you can sell a futures contract and make delivery on it. And then you satisfy your requirements by making delivery. It is the buyer's problem to find this storage that we're running out of. And the buyer's going to be the problem. Now, what's been happening with all of this retail surge that we have to pick the low in crude oil, they are generating long buying of crude oil futures. So they are giving the producers an avenue and a way to make delivery to further exacerbate this problem when it comes to the storage. Now, along the way, you'll say, well, wait a minute. A lot of these people are just paper traders. This all goes away. Yes, in normal times, that is true. But in these abnormal times where storage is running out, that this buying interest by the public is giving these producers an avenue to make delivery, a way to keep producing when we don't need it and find a way to sell it to somebody via delivery of the futures contract.
Jim, I want to summarize some of this and put it in context to make sure all of our listeners understand it. What we're talking about here is USO is going to bring a whole bunch of new, frankly, ignorant retail money into this market, and it's going to result in USO buying lots and lots of futures contracts. Normally, the way that works is the people on the other side of that trade are financial traders. They're people that intend to close their position before the end of the month. They're going to make or lose. USO is going to make or lose. Everybody makes or loses, and that's just the way it goes. What we're anticipating here is that the crude oil producers are no dummies. They're saying, if I try to sell my crude oil on the spot market, I can get 12 bucks. I can get like 28 bucks if I sell it on the futures market. Now, this is important to understand. They changed the structure recently of the USO ETP. So instead of just investing in the front month futures contract, they invest in the first four contracts, 20% in the first month, which is now June, 40% in the second month, which is now July, 20% in the third month, which is now August, and 20% in the fourth month, which is now the September delivery contract. What that means is, if I look at the September delivery contract as we're speaking, that's still, you know, almost $25 right now, which is not great in historical norms, but it's still enough to, you know, it beats the heck out of 15 bucks on the spot market. The producers are going to be selling into USO. And here's the most important thing to understand. There's no signal or chart or indicator that tells us which of these short positions in the market intend to deliver oil against their short position and which ones intend to make financial settlement. We don't find out about that until the contract is almost ready to expire. So what we end up with is a whole bunch of producers that are selling futures contracts to the USO ETF. Now, the USO ETF doesn't have a storage tank. They can't accept delivery of that oil. What they do is they roll their futures contracts forward to the next delivery month. When they do that, they have to sell their open futures contract, and who they normally sell it to is one of the paper shorts in the market who needs to roll his short position forward into the next contract. Jim, what happens if USO wants to sell a whole bunch of these long futures contracts, but all the sellers are producers who have the intention of delivery?
If you look at the slide deck, page 10, you'll see some tables. And those tables show on the left-hand side the positions of the United States Oil Fund, USO, as of Friday, April 24th, and the positions of the ProShares Bloomberg Crude Oil Index, which is the second largest crude oil ETP, exchange-traded product, on the right. What you'll see on the table on the left, and the bottom half shows you the pending trades that USO did on Friday that will settle into the contract on Monday, the 27th. What they will show you is USO has 43,000 contracts in June. It has 90,000 July contracts. And if you include the ProShares Ultra, it has another 44,000 July contracts as well, too. So between ProShares and USO, that's 130,000 July contracts. That's a roughly one-third of July's open interest, especially if you add in all of the other smaller crude oil ETFs. Now, why am I bringing this up? Because this buying is creating a market for the seller. Now, again, the seller is motivated because of this unusual circumstance that we have no storage. So this is giving them an out. If we had storage, there'd be no reason for them to look to the futures market as an outlet for delivery. But because we're out of storage, they can shift the burden off of them to find storage and shift it to a futures holder that can buy, that can own it. This is what happened conceptually with the May contract last week, is that as it became, as it was expiring in the last 2 days, all of these longs were looking to get out, but there was no paper sellers of it. Everybody that was owning it, not everybody, but a lot of those people that were still there that owned it, intended on making delivery. They didn't want delivery. They wanted to get out of that contract. Eventually, they were paying somebody to take it from them all the way down to minus $37. Now, what's happening here is that we are building that same type of situation. Now, I am not suggesting we're going to go to minus $37 on any of these contracts. But what I am suggesting is we are creating an imbalance here with all of this retail money piling in, giving buyers of the futures contracts, all of these producers that need to continue to produce can sell it to them. Quick word about producers in the United States. Just a general comment. If you have a well in the United States, you have to run it at about 60% of capacity, if not higher. If you dip below that, you risk damaging the well or safety concerns. So you could cut back production to about 60%. And then your next step is to cap the well and go all the way to zero, which is horribly expensive because you have to do it right so you don't damage the well, and horribly expensive to reopen it. So their preference is to continue to produce at their minimum threshold. They can't linearly just keep cutting back and cutting back and cutting back. And the futures contracts are allowing them to do exactly that. I could continue to produce at 60%, even though that's too much oil. I could sell futures contracts against it. It's now the buyer of the futures contract's problem to figure out what to do with that oil. In normal times, that's not an issue, but this is not normal.
Jim, I want to invoke an analogy to your experience and mine in early February, when everybody thought we were a couple of nutcases because we're talking about a global pandemic. And everybody's saying, you idiots, pay attention to the news. Look, it's in China. China's got a really bad problem. It's in Hubei province. There hasn't been a single death outside China. You know, what are you guys worried about? And of course, what you and I knew is we understood the concept of asymptomatic transmission and a long incubation period. And we knew that there was a silent contagion spreading around the world. The fact that there were flights in and out of China every day meant that people who were contagious, even if they were asymptomatic, were spreading the virus around the world, and it was only a matter of time before the really big black swan event that everybody said was, you know, impossible to predict happened, even though it was very easy for you and I to predict it. What I see here is analogous in the following way. I think there's a silent contagion spreading through the first 4 months of the crude oil futures curve. The June, July, August, and September contracts have an artificial bid that's coming from USO and the other crude oil ETPs. It's bringing a huge amount of short open interest into the market that is held by producers who have no intention of rolling those contracts forward. Their intention is to deliver their oil into the market, because they know that it's the buyer's problem to come up with where the storage is. Now, if you had this happening where there's an imbalance, where there's more physical sellers than there are physical buyers, so you've got a bunch of paper buyers and physical sellers, normally the resolution to that is the storage guys make a killing, because the guys who have available storage can come in, and as the price starts to crash just before the contract expires, they can buy it at a steep discount, put it in their storage tank, and they're smiling all the way to the bank. Here's the thing. What happens when all the storage tanks are full and there are no storage guys to come swooping in at the last minute and buy those contracts for $10 or $12 cheaper than what the next month's contract is selling for? What if there is no more storage available at any price? And the answer is the price just keeps going down, including going negative. And Jim, I feel like there is a very real possibility. You know, the anomaly that happened in May had to do with that imbalance existing after options expiration, which means really there's almost all of the open interest is out of the market at that point. There was 100,000 contracts going into that day, which is pretty big for the last day, but it's much less than the front month usually has. I think there's a possibility of getting to zero or negative prices. I don't know about June, but certainly in July, before we get to options expiration day, I think we could see that phenomenon. What do you think?
Yes, I think two things to keep in mind, and that is one, the supply and demand imbalance that I talked about, the 6 million barrels a day of crude oil that we're using for driving when we normally use 10, that's not going away anytime soon. We might restart the economy soon, but we're not going to restart, I don't believe, and then immediately see it rocket right back up to 10 million barrels a day. We're not going to, when they blow the whistle and say, okay, quarantine over, I don't think we're going to see everybody say, okay, I'm going to start driving again exactly the way I was last year. That demand will stay down. The producers will still keep producing, and then the price will go negative. And here's where the financial crisis kicks in. Is as the price goes negative, the legal structures of these ETPs, these exchange-traded products, are these investors that buy into these, they think they're capped at zero. They think the worst they can lose is all their money. So there was a story in the Wall Street Journal last week. They talked to some retail traders that bought $1,000 or $2,000 worth of USO, which is 1,000 shares. And they said that they're willing to ride it all the way down, which they meant was zero. Okay, what happens if the price goes to negative? There's a loss that continues to build and build and build. But you can't go back to the holders of a regulated SEC account and say, hey, I know you lost all your money because the price went to zero. But now that the price went negative, you got to start writing me checks and continuing to cover that loss. They won't do it. And so then it falls to either the manager of the fund, or it falls to the broker that did the trades, or as the ultimate backstop, it falls to the clearinghouse of the exchange. There is a loss in there and somebody has to eat it. And it's exactly that. So as the price builds up and builds up, and as the producers sell and sell and sell, and as the brokers and the manager starts realizing, hey, there's going to be a squeeze here because we're going to have a hard time getting out of these contracts because everybody wants to make delivery. They don't want to exit the trade. They're going to start trying to get out of these trades. 130,000 July contracts. You know, there's a nearly 100,000 more August contracts as well, too. And this can build up to causing them to see what happened in May. And what I mean is liquidate earlier than we normally see. The June contract will have to get rolled between May 5th and May 8th. That should be interesting, but I'd be surprised if you saw something at all like we saw last week with that roll. But then I think after that, another month or two of these producers selling into this, you could see a real problem and potentially not the last of negative prices. Remember, if there's a negative price, the USO holders are done at zero. Somebody's got to eat that loss. And that's where you potentially build into a financial crisis if it gets bad enough. If it's a minor loss, minus 20 cents, they can cover it. If it comes minus $10 or something like that, then it can be start talking about some real money and real problems.
And I want to go a little bit deeper on those mechanics, Jim, because what some of our more astute listeners who are futures traders would say is, no, it doesn't work that way, because as soon as USO gets down to its maintenance margin level, when it doesn't have enough equity to sustain all of these contracts, their broker is going to start selling those contracts in order to liquidate the fund so that they can come out with just a zero balance. They might have to shut down the fund, it goes bankrupt, but it never gets to a negative balance where the fund owes the broker money in normal times when they're able to liquidate those contracts. Now, I want you to ask yourself, suppose we discover as we're approaching options expiration that there's just a whole lot more, a record percentage of open interest on the short side is held by producers who intend to deliver, and they will not cover their short at any price. They're going to deliver their oil because they need to get rid of their oil. At that point, the broker steps in and says, hey, USO is at maintenance margin. We're going to sell at the market, liquidate. Hey, there is no bid. We can't sell at the market because there is no market, and USO is so big that it owns a quarter of the market. That's the point where all of a sudden the system just breaks down. It doesn't work anymore because the mechanism for the broker to liquidate at negative prices or whatever it is, even if the price drops to minus $1,000 a barrel, if there's nobody who's got a tank who can buy that contract and physically take delivery, it can go to infinity. At that point, what do you do? The system's not really designed to accommodate that possibility because it's never been thought that that could occur. How far do we get down this path before something goes bump in the night and we suddenly figure this out? And I think there's a reflexive thing. If you were to have some roll event, whether it's USO rolling or just approaching OPEX, and one contract suddenly goes deeply negative, I think there's probably an aha moment where people figure out, maybe it's just when they listen to this podcast, I don't know, when people figure out, hey, wait a minute, there's all of this huge amount of stealth physical short open interest in the first 4 months, and it all has to come to a head, and there's never going to be enough buyers to deal with all the sellers because there's not enough storage. Oh, shit. Sell the 4 months, all four of them, because their value is zero or less than zero. And you see, first the failure happens in the front month, and then people figure it out, and then the next day, the following 3 months, all crash to zero or crash to negative. That's not a prediction, folks. Nobody's smart enough to know exactly how something like this would play out. What we're telling you is we see risks that could lead to an event that the design of the system does not incorporate. It's something beyond what the futures market is designed to be capable of coping with. And if this were to happen, it could just create a force majeure situation where there's no choice, I guess, but for the government to step in and somehow bail everything out. I don't know how it would go down. What are your thoughts, Jim?
You know, there's the perception is the government would step in. Steve Mnuchin said that. I think that's inspiring a lot of retail buying. They're not going to let the crude oil market or the energy market go down, so they're buying on the idea that there's going to be a bailout. But keep in mind, a bailout, I don't know how you bail them out because once you get into that imbalanced situation, even if the Fed or the Treasury starts writing checks to make everybody whole, you're just telling them, keep doing it again for the following month. Keep doing it again for the following month. What we need to have happen is either we need some of these producers to start capping wells and start severely cutting back on production, but they're trying not to do that. And the Treasury Department, through Steve Mnuchin, said, we don't want you to do that. We want the energy industry to continue. Okay, they can't build tanker farms in 10 days, so that's not going to be the fix as well. The ultimate fix would be, I think, is to shut down all these ETPs. But there's a problem there. They make the exchanges, they make the brokers, they make Wall Street a lot of money, these ETPs. There's a lot of trading that goes on with this. No one wants to shut those down. This is money for this. This is revenue for them. So they're going to fight that one as well, too. It's somewhat analogous to 2008. We knew in 2008, and we now know, especially with happenstance, but some knew contemporaneously, that a lot of these derivatives, the CDOs that were tied to mortgages, were a flawed structure and that they were going to lead to problems. But the minute you brought up, hey, this is a flawed structure, lead to problems, somebody on the other side said, yes, but look how much money we're making on this. We can't stop it now, because if we do, we're going to lose a lot of money. So this is where we're going to go. The most reasonable fix would be to shut down these ETPs or severely restrict these ETPs. Well, they're not going to do that. They're going to do a 1-for-8 split, you know, on Tuesday to try and encourage more retail into the ETP as well. So we're going to continue to see this build and build and build. The other fix might be if we do have a miraculous restart with the economy. What I mean by miraculous is we immediately go from 6 million barrels a day of gasoline consumption to 10 in a couple of weeks, just as fast as we fell on my slide on page 2. And then we could then work off some of that inventory. But I don't see us regaining that lost demand anytime soon. So no, this is not, we're going to have a crisis tomorrow. We're not going to have a crisis next month. But what we are doing is we're headed on a road of imbalance, which I think can get worse and worse. And as people become aware of the problems, it's going to lead to more and more problems with arguably the most important commodity in the world, and that is crude oil.
And Jim, I think it's really important that we stress this point. It would seem intuitively like, hey, if there's no place to put the oil, if there's nobody to take it from you, then any intelligent producer of oil, any oil company, would cap their wells, shut in production, and stop producing oil. But here's the thing. It's an existential threat for many of these companies. Now, what they see is, wait a minute, we can keep going. We can keep producing. We're not dummies. We know there's no place to put this oil. But what we can do is we can make that somebody else's problem. By selling forward in the futures market, we lock in our price. We're going to get paid enough money that we can stay in business for this oil. We're going to produce the oil. We know damn well that when we deliver it, there's going to be nobody who's got a tank. But the thing is, contractually, it's not our problem anymore. It's somebody else's problem. So what we have is an entire industry that continues to produce oil that there's no place to put it. You can't have the refineries refine it because there's no place to store the finished products when they do. That storage is full too. You can't export it to anybody because there's no spare capacity for storage overseas. There's no place to put it, but they're going to continue producing it because there is a buyer for it. Who's the buyer? It's the USO ETP and the other ETPs. And it's people who have no place to store that oil. Their money is going into buying it. They're going to forfeit all that money when they get to the delivery point and the price crashes to zero because there's no storage. And we have a big financial disaster that happens. Now, let's assume somehow, Jim, that the financial disaster got bailed out or something. I don't know how it would be resolved. But I want to stress, there's still a physical logistic crisis, which is an existential threat to the entire U.S. shale industry. That is, all of these oil producers, they produced all their oil, and they said, hey, look, here's our story. We produced our oil. Here's our oil. This is the delivery day in the contract, in the futures contract. What we sold was the July contract. That means delivery in July. There's a date in the contract. That's when they're supposed to deliver it. It has to go either in tank storage or in a pipeline. As per the contract, we're ready to deliver. And we're not offering free storage in our tank for 1 minute after that. Whoever bought it, come and get it, because it's not staying in our tank. It's got to go out because we need the space in our tank. Well, okay, even if there's a government bailout, if there just is no place to store this oil that's already been produced, there's no way for anybody to take delivery of it, what happens then? We get a logjam where every tank is full of oil, but everybody is fighting with each other, saying, no, wait a minute, you only had the lease on that tank till the end of the month. Your obligation was to empty it, and you didn't empty it. You owe us money. You owe us double rent. But the next guy says, I already paid for that tank, and I've got oil that I need to deliver into it, and it's not empty. You owe me an empty tank. Everybody's fighting over the logistics, even if you had a bailout of the financial transactions on the actual purchase and sale of the oil. I don't know how that gets all resolved, because there's a financial incentive for the entire industry to continue producing oil that they know perfectly well there's no place to put when they're done producing it.
Yeah, and I would add a couple of more things. I've mentioned this before, but remember, the administration's official position is they don't want the industry to stop either. They don't want shut-ins and capped wells. So they're going to try and find a way to get them to go. The Texas Railroad Commission, I know it's a funny sounding name, but they are the regulator of oil in the state of Texas. They have the ability to impose limits on production. They held a meeting last week, and believe me, they know this problem better than you and me. They couldn't come to an agreement to cut production. And they said, well, we'll meet again May 5th and try again. They're getting enormous pressure from the producers to not shut them in and not cut the production. Because remember, if you're running at 60% and you tell them, hey, I need you to shut in a little bit more, my next stop is zero. I can't just keep linearly going down. I'll ruin my well if I keep going. That's the problem with oil, is that you just can't keep cutting until you're barely producing anything at all. It's a bit binary once you get down to your minimums, and they're very close to those right now. So everybody's got this incentive to keep the industry going. They're highly leveraged. There's a lot of junk bond offerings out there right now with them. There's a lot of other formerly investment grade debt that has been downgraded, fallen angels like Occidental Petroleum. And they need production to keep going, because if you shut them in, you got widespread defaults all over the place in the industry. So they can't. What I'm trying to say is that simple answer is just stop producing is not so easy. Just start consuming. That's not so easy either as well. Stop the USO gravy train. There's a lot of financial interests that don't want to stop that one as either. So there isn't a simple fix to this. Right now, they're hoping, oh, we're overstating the case, and they'll kind of just meander around. Maybe the price falls to single digits, but it stays above zero. The system stays whole. It's painful, but we survive to live another day. That's what they're hoping for right now. And my problem with this is, if you see what's happening, as you so eloquently said, when we're out of storage, there's only wishful thinking that the price will stop at zero. It will continue to go because people will then pay to take it off their hands. And that's a negative price. And again, then it falls to some of these legal structures. You can't go back to them for money once they go negative. And either the broker, the manager, or the exchange at the worst case has to start eating a loss. And that's the risk that we face right now.
Jim, final topic. Let's go through the timeline and the calendar and talk about what things our listeners should be watching for. Seems to me the first thing to watch is on the 28th, that's this coming Tuesday, USO has filed for a reverse split. They also filed to increase the number of authorized shares, because right now USO is unable to buy more futures contracts because they're not able to create more shares of the ETF. They can trade the ones that are already in existence, but in order to buy more futures contracts, they have to be able to create new shares of that ETP, and they filed for permission to do that. Now, assuming that both of those things happen, I believe the date is Tuesday the 28th, that we might expect to see some significant retail inflows into USO that result in buying more futures contracts. So the thing to watch there would be the open interest starting on the 28th in those first four futures contracts to see if the number of contracts goes up. And if it does, it means that the ETP is buying more. And we're guessing that the other side of that trade is going to be producers. You and I don't know that with certainty, but that's kind of the core of our thesis as to what might be going on. Jim, what's the next significant date after April 28th that we should be thinking about?
May 5th, the Texas Railroad Commission, they have the power to invoke or force a production cut. May 5th to 8th is the roll of the June contract where the USOs and all of the other ETPs will roll out of their June positions, and we'll have to see where that goes for. May 14th is OPEX expiration. That is another date as well, too. And don't forget that along the way, we can always have rumors of another OPEC meeting. We can have rumors of economies or states opening, maybe increasing the demand for crude oil. The president has already announced that he wants to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The problem there is it's only 75 million barrels until it's completely topped off. And they've got a pipeline problem. You could say we want to refill it, but it's not that simple. You can't put 75 million barrels in it in 1 week. You could do it over a period of several weeks or a few months, whereas we're going to run out of storage in a couple of weeks. So those are some of the things that you can look at in terms of what is out there in terms of the other dates as well, too.
So let's just talk through those May dates a little more. My feeling, and I want to get your perspective as well, 5 through 8 of June, okay, that's when USO is rolling its positions forward to the next month. The thing is, they've moved a lot of their WTI exposure in June over to the ICE exchange. I don't know how that is going to impact, you know, which exchange it's on. I am not even familiar with that contract. I'm guessing that it's also Cushing delivery. They've got only 13,000 contracts in June on the NYMEX contract. I think it's plausible that we could have, you know, some big blow-up event on that role during that process from the 5th to the 8th. But frankly, I think it's pretty darn unlikely. I think the first time that we might see the kind of chaos that you and I are talking about starting might be sometime the week of May 11th. And of course, May 14th, options expiration day, is also when position limits go into effect. That means all the paper traders, at least the big ones, have to close or at least reduce their positioning so that nobody has more than 3,000 contracts as of 2:30 p.m. on the 14th. It would be coming into that. If we were going to have a major problem, I think it might show up there. And then, you know, it's plausible that contract, the June contract, the last day of trading is May 19th. May 18th, it's called the penultimate day, the day before the last day. That's when everything blew up for the May contract, was on that penultimate day. I don't see the history repeating exactly. I think that the problem we have to worry about is not the situation that happened that pushed the May contract negative when there was only a few thousand contracts still in open interest at that point. I think we have to worry about it happening on OPEX day or before. For it to happen in May for the June contract, I don't know. I'm going to say it's less than a 50-50, Jim, that it happens then as opposed to next month. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. I don't think that May 5th to 8th, there's a long shot possibility that you have that problem. By the way, the ICE contract has got the same structure as the WTI contract. It easily arbitrage trades within a penny or two of the other contract as well. But the July expiration in early June. Now, if the estimates are right, we will have already run out of storage by the time you get to that date. May 5th, it's still, we expect to run out of storage. But by June, it's already out. And we might even be at a force majeure situation with June then at that point. And we'll have to see how they handle that. And then they could run into problems of negative prices as you go into that situation, or July, if we make it that far as well, too. This is under the assumption, which is what we all believe is going to happen, is somewhere in the month of May, probably by the middle of May, storage will be done, will be completely out, and you can't build a tanker farm in a week. So you are going to have a real problem then on your hands after mid-May. So it's that early June expiration for the July contract, I think, is where I'd probably focus more of my attention on.
So the week of June 8th is when the ETPs are going to be rolling their positions. I don't have the exact dates in front of me. It's probably 10, 11, 12 of June. Then the following week on Wednesday, June 17th, that's the actual options expiration day. If it hasn't hit the fan by then, I think going into OPEX would be where things fall apart. Because remember, that date in mid-June is for the expiration of the July contract. That's the one that right now has 40% of USO's open interest. Now, of course, they're going to roll some of those positions forward, and they won't have that many. But the thing is, the shorts, the physical shorts, are already coming into the market. So the further out that we get, the larger the concentration of those physical shorts that can create a massive imbalance at contract expiration, which is really where the key to this is. Jim, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners your Twitter handle, website, where they can follow your work.
Thanks, Eric. At Bianco Research is my Twitter handle. You can find me on LinkedIn under my name, Jim Bianco, and our website is biancoresearch.com.
This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast on quant and rules-based investing. Be sure to claim your free copy of their recently updated guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following strategies, which is linked in your Research Roundup email. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.